This is the ASC podcast brought to you by the Communications Committee of the Association for Surgical Education. Embracing the mission of excellence, innovation, and scholarship, the ASC is impacting surgical education globally.
This is your podcast moderator, Mingli Wang. Thanks for joining us. The topic today is LGBTQI plus surgical community, advocating for faculty and residents, and ultimately improving patient care through a more diverse workforce. I'm excited to introduce our guests today, Drs. Gordana Rask and David Shapiro. I'm going to let them introduce themselves to you. And I'll start with Gordana.
Well, thank you for having me. So my name is Dr. Gordana Rasek. I'm a general surgery resident over at Boston Medical Center and Boston University Chobanian and Epidisian School of Medicine. And I am also a current research fellow. And just a little bit about what my interests are is it's kind of a three-pronged approach. I work in a translational science lab where we're investigating circulating tumor DNA as a diagnostic marker for postoperative surveillance and head and neck squamous cell carcinoma. But then I've also engaged in work for large-scale database research evaluating disparities in oncologic care, primarily in hepatobiliary cancers. But really, during my fellowship, I've ended up kind of falling in love with ongoing interest of mine with diversity, equity, inclusion realm, which is primarily of advocacy of LGBTQA plus trainees in surgical residency programs, as well as for our students, and a personal niche about mentoring across identity differences. And then with that, I currently serve on the executive board for the Association of Surgeons and Allies as the resident and fellow representative, along with my co-representative, Dr. A. St. John. And most of my work will be aiming for an interest in surgical oncology and surgical education.
Thanks, Dr. Rasek. I'm sorry I pronounced your last name wrong. So forgive me and give me grace, and I'll do better next time. And thank you for that very humble introduction. Dr. Shapiro.
So good afternoon, and thank you for having me and colleagues here. So my name is David Shapiro. My pronouns are he, him, and I will also add L because I know that we're multilingual in our world. I'm going to say that I think the most important thing for me about being here is that I am a general surgeon. I trained in critical care and trauma, general surgery. I'm also boarded in palliative care and hospice, and I've been doing this for almost 20 years. And my experience coming through the surgical training process was not good when it first started. I found that people were used pejorative terms. They were horrible to others. And I was very much afraid of being one of those people victimized because of who I was and for being a member of the LGBT community and being a gay surgeon. Through the years, though, I've been able to establish myself as, I hope, a leader and a guide and an influencer in this world, and I've written some work on it. My real area of passion is I've always been interested in injury prevention, and I work with the American College of Surgeons as one of the leads for the Stop the Bleed program. I work with, I'm the president of our Connecticut chapter of the American College of Surgeons, and I'm on the Committee on Trauma. And I've been interested and enthusiastic over the last several years of those two worlds colliding. And now that I'm the president of our local chapter, we've included diversity, equity, and inclusivity as not just a committee in our organization, but as a standing issue on every question, every committee, and every table. I think one of the most important things, and Gordana alluded to this, is that we have to have this type of inclusivity at every step. You can't just have a committee that manages it. It has to be at the forefront every day. And the reason I wear my progressive pride pin every day is not for me to say I'm gay. It's for me to say you're welcome here. And the people that are out there either working in the building I'm in, patients coming in, or colleagues saying, oh, I see you're wearing a pride pin. In their mind, maybe saying, great. Or in their mind saying, I don't know what that is. Or out loud saying, finally I found someone who can make me feel comfortable where I am. I'm also a founding member of the Association of Outsurgeons and Allies, along which on whose board I sit with Dr. Rasik, and that's very exciting. And as a new organization, the purpose is really to generate interest in surgery from all the folks out there who find themselves in any category, whether it's LGBTQIA+, and that means allies included, but we want those allies to be accepting, not just tolerant and good companions, but also supportive and elevating. And I think it used to be that we were very private about our LGBT status because people were afraid, and we can't be ruled by fear. If you decide that you're going to be out, we need to not only accept you, but embrace you. And the recent article I wrote is all about making sure that we act as a beacon to those people who are in pre-med, STEM high school programs, so that we see young women, men, and other genders all have access to this specialty, because surgery is the coolest of all specialties. I can be biased in saying that, and really promote the interest in that from all levels.
Thank you so much for sharing your personal journey, experience, and you know, you both have used some really terms that maybe a lot of people might not be as familiar with. For example, what does, like, why do we need to be discussing identity? Why is that important to surgeons who are doing operations, for example?
Or Danny, you want to take that first?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, it is extremely important to consider someone's identity, because if we're going to serve, and then, if we're talking about training for residents, trainees, but also constructing like a really supportive environment for faculty as well. From an educational standpoint, you have to understand that, like, what is the setting that you're currently practicing in, and then who are you talking to, and what are the challenges they are facing? Because those may be unique to someone, standing right next to them. I think it's interesting. If you look back, just kind of defined a setting in residency training, and for our students, a recent household poll survey in the U.S. Estimated around 8% of individuals, around 20 million adults, identifying as lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender. And I will mention that the note with that is that the LGBTQI+ identity is in the community, the identities captured in the community, a whole different spectrum, right? So like, they're not considering those that identify as asexual or intersex, or even questioning with that data. But when they look over at US med schools, we have around 6.3% of our students identifying as lesbian, gay, and bi, bisexual, but we don't have that information for transgendered students. And then some other surveys have revealed that around 4.8% of our trainees in general surgery programs identify as lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender. The problem here is a lot of this data is very much acquired partly from survey studies. We don't really have this information collected from the ACGME, ERAS, or the American Board of Surgery. And we have a little bit of insight to say, even with these preliminary numbers, that this is an underrepresented group that's going to encounter their own challenges throughout training, not just with surgical training, but the people that they interact with on a daily basis. But we really need to capture those numbers so we can have a better idea of how diverse or lack of diversity our field is. And then considering then, not just for recruitment efforts, but also retention. So what are our attrition rates? We've seen that happen. We've seen that there are disproportionate attrition rates of other underrepresented groups, but we don't have the information for the LGBTQI+ population. A little spilling into, defining the setting, we have to understand what is happening and why identity is important. And there have been preliminary surveys that have shown that students just throughout their clinical rotations that identify as LGBTQIA+ have increased experience of mistreatment, of discrimination, public humiliation, and even unwanted advances. And so another survey study then evaluate, what is the perceived inclusivity? And unfortunately, a lot of surgical specialties were considered less inclusive, and those entail general surgery, colorectal surgery, thoracic, neurosurgery, as well as orthopedic surgery. And so we already see here is potential issues that are impeding our ability to recruit these students into our field. And, you know, studies have shown that having a more diverse workforce actually translates to better patient outcomes, that these providers can help construct a more inclusive environment for our patients, to being more mindful about like the pronouns they use, what are social determinants of health that's impacting their ability to get preventative care, even corrective care, or like treatment for any pathologies that they're encountering. And so, you know, that is, that's one part to it. And then unfortunately, similar issues are happening with residents in surgical training as well. There's a recent study, I believe of Heidershot et al. Around 2014 in JAMA Surgery that revealed that LGBT residents ended up experiencing increased rates of bullying, mistreatment, discrimination, and even unwanted sexual advances, primarily from attending surgeons, which is already alarming as it is. And then when they looked at, well, what is the outcome of these effects, is that these residents were twice as more likely to consider leaving the program. And so we've opened the doors partly to let these residents into our sphere, into our training environment, but we're not, you know, we're not creating an inclusive environment to keep them there. And, you know, we can't really contextualize what the attrition rates are, but that's definitely a next step for a lot of our researchers and our leaders and organizations to work on. And so I think once you kind of get an idea of the identity and how that plays a role in terms of what these trainees are experiencing during their clinical environment or throughout their clinical environment, then we can have a better idea of, okay, so what is happening institutionally and then what resources can we construct to actually create an inclusive environment and also to make an equitable environment and being mindful of what these trainees may be going through in their personal lives and then, you know, address it from there. But I won't go on too long, so I'll let Dr. Shapiro take on and then we can go further.
And I'll add to that. So I think Granada put a lot of things in a perspective for folks. And I think the most subtle versions of what we experience in surgery residency is what's most important, because whether you're a student in the operating room, a resident in the operating room, have you heard the term off-task talk? You know, are you supposed to be talking about the case before you? You're supposed to be talking about your, you know, how's your dog? How's your wife? How's your family? But when you're a person who is LGBT, let's say you're a gay surgeon as a resident or a gay man as a student, and someone says, oh, my wife's doing this. Hey, I heard that your wife is looking for this. And then you start talking, oh, David, are you married? And the answer is no. They say, oh, okay, well, you know, I'll set you up sometime with my wife's sister. Well, that's completely inappropriate, number one. Number two, they make an assumption. We cannot assume what we know about people. And the reason, I think, in my humble opinion for pronouns, is that it sets tone and it sets welcoming and it sets an expectation. When I put my, so mine even says he, him, be you, because that's what I always say in my LinkedIn profile. It says that there because I want people to feel more comfortable. The most important pronouns we can talk about are us and you. It's about being welcoming and inclusive together. But if somebody's new to the group and they want to come in and you say, hey, who's she? And they're them, you're excluding them automatically. And if we can focus on things like the microaggression, not first, but at the same time as the macroaggression and overt discrimination, then we can help people understand that when you're when you have a bell curve of people's experiences, and on one end you have the overtly racist, discriminatory, and bigoted people, the other end you have the completely accepting and not a worry, and then in the middle you have everyone else. If we can shift those people who don't understand over to the understanding, you take away the non-overt versions of discrimination. And you allow them to ally with you because they can and they will. They just don't know the terminology to use. I think, in addition, I think, you know, aside from the stats that Dana mentioned, one of the most important things that we even can consider is really going back to basics and figuring out what we need to do. we're mentors, we're advocates, we're sponsors. Gordana, I don't remember what year you are. I think you're in the middle of like between your clinical two and clinical 4 year, right? Somewhere in there. Yeah. Doing research, you do these extra years in the middle and you get to explore. But as a mentor, as a sponsor, and as an advocate, whether you're gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender, straight, queer, questioning, or anywhere in between or outside, it remains as much of our job to offer sponsorship and mentorship to LGBTQ plus learners as it is to any other learner. And if I am a white male, I am a cis white male, I am what people expect when they see a leadership position in some hospitals. My job is to then say to the people that are around me, I want more people who look like not me to be in leadership positions. I want people who represent something different than me in a role. So my role now is that I'm a chief medical officer. And in conjunction with our hospital leadership, we've been able to increase the number of women in leadership positions by about 40% in the last year and a half alone. That's part of it, but it needs to be more. There's always more we can do.
Thanks. I heard a lot of the importance of promoting diversity and inclusivity in the surgical workforce and in the way that we recruit and retain our trainees. And I'm really excited now. So like for someone who doesn't identify as LGBTQ plus, but want to do the welcoming inclusivity and bring that into the surgical trainee and workforce, what would you both suggest steps to better support our surgical trainees and colleagues in this community? So not just like LGBTQ. I mean, what I also hear is just like, you know, that have different identities than ourselves.
So I'll make the first shameless plug. And part of this is because these organizations matter. If you are an academic institution and you have a residency, whether you're a university or not, you need to be a member of the organizations out there that are representing people in the minority of profession of your profession in them. So for instance, the Society of Black Academic Surgeons, you don't have to be an academic surgeon to be in that organization. You have to be, you don't have to be a Black surgeon, but we have to recognize them. You don't have to have the Association of Women and Women Surgeons doesn't have to be the forefront of your organization, but you should participate in their actions. You should have the ability to ask people when they apply to your program or when they're starting in your program, put your name on your coat, what's your preferred name, and then ask them, tell us your pronouns so you can put that on your business card. Little things like that, even if they're not LGBTQ plus, they recognize that and go, okay, it's becoming more and more at the forefront. I think the other thing is that, I won't show you the page, but on the Association of Out Surgeons and Allies front page, an organization that has been around for officially 6 months, has University of California at San Francisco, NYU Langone, Northwell Health, Brigham and Women's Hospital, Mass General, the Weill Cornell School of Medicine, Michigan Medicine, and Duke Surgery. Eight of the most premier surgical organizations in the world, and they're all PRISM institutional sponsors and members of that organization. They have embraced the concept of opening their doors and making sure that people know that they are welcome in their institution by doing that. Now, people may still face problems in those places, but they have committed to it by doing that. It may be something that I'm trying to promote, but it's also a step that means that you care and you make a difference. I think they should do the same thing for Black Academic Surgery, AWS, all the organizations that represent those who are underrepresented.
Perfect. And then I'll chime in. I completely agree with those sentiments. And I think it's, you know, what Dr. Shapiro was saying is that not only being able to have those organizations that, you know, in regards to the resources that they, you know, offer, whether it's mentorship programs or, you know, accessibility to conferences. And I know several of them work on actually sponsoring underrepresented in medicine trainees and students to conferences. But the other thing is, you know, if you are a mentor of an LGBTQA plus trainee, you know, there has been concerns that some people just they may have an issue that's brought to them as a mentor, and they don't feel that they completely understand from that trainee's like experience, just because identity differences are there. And so I think if there aren't sufficient like institutional support mechanisms, which, you know, that can always vary based on funding and resources that are available within each program, these organizations can be extremely helpful resource. You can connect them with other leaders who are perhaps more familiar of how to address some of these incidences of either macro or microaggressions, whether they're coming in from coworkers or from patient experiences, unfortunately, and helping the trainees kind of navigate, you know, what are the resources they can use and how to process what has happened. The other thing we can do, I think, as a program, and what our allies can also help advocate for, is looking at what systems are in place to address when microaggressions occur. You know, some institutions have reporting systems, which are great. You know, you can have anonymity about amongst the incidents that are reported, and you know, have a leadership or a faculty member or whoever's in charge of it address these issues. But I think, you know, that's a more of a corrective approach. You know, it's really not looking at it from a preventative approach. So we kind of need both. We need a reporting system that's in place so that when these incidences occur, when discrimination happens against LGBTQA plus trainees, they have an avenue to go to and address that issue now. And you know, whatever happened can be resolved with more education and so on. But you also need a preventative strategy too. And that can involve bias training for faculty as well as staff. I think also bystander training. That is something that can be extremely helpful for allies. If you are witnessing any homophobic or transphobic remarks being made in the clinical setting, you can respond appropriately. And in that way, right, like we have to be mindful that we're not placing a minority tax or a burden onto these trainees or faculty members that incur these, you know, these really unfortunate and horrible experiences. And then we can step up and speak for them because they are in a vulnerable position. You know, I think when we think about like student mistreatment or resident mistreatment, you're in a position where you're going to be reporting someone who's in charge of evaluating you. And so I think that can alleviate some of that burden and that anxiety. And also the other thing to consider is maybe that person just isn't out. And so perhaps that person isn't out. You don't know that they're LGBTQIA+, but you can at least recognize an ally that a transphobic remark was made. And so that you are kind of creating a culture of safety and the intolerance of that kind of behavior by reporting that and being the bystander. I think, you know, one thing to share that we have at our institution, which we're quite proud of, is we actually have DEI fellows of every specialty that's present. So medicine, surgery, will be gone and so on. They actually appoint, each department appoints two residents that serve as DEI fellows of Boston Medical Center of the institution. And this is also administratively supported by faculty as well. And these individuals actually undergo training of how to respond to these incidences that get reported. And they actually go through training of how to report this issue and who are the appropriate people to talk to. And we actually have them available 24/7. They take turns on being on call. And then there's also accessibility that if you're in a surgery department and you do incur this kind of incident, then you don't have to talk to your surgery DEI fellow. You can just end up, you know, calling whatever DEI fellow you feel most comfortable with and they'll advocate on your behalf. But, you know, those are a lot of resources, but I think they're all something to consider and, you know, do, you know, at least start working on one that you think would probably be the best, most beneficial in terms of what the needs are of that, of your institution. But yeah.
I want to add one thing to what Cordana said, because I think you raised a few very good points. One thing that I think maybe even Cordana hasn't thought about yet, because you are a resident in training and you're going through all the process, but maybe you have, I'm curious to see what you think about this. When I post a job opportunity in my institution, mm-hmm. I want to make sure that, you know, when I sign off on that at the bottom, that says the contact information goes to this recruiter, Danielle Howe. I want that to say she, her. Why? Because those two small words say to the applicant, maybe it's just that person, but maybe that institution. It says more than when it's not there. When it's not there, you just don't know. When it's there, it makes a difference. Email signatures, business cards. My business cards do not have it on it, but my email signature does. And it makes such a difference when you do that sort of thing.
It does. It does. I can say so. And then my apologies for not making it more clear at the beginning, but my pronouns are she, her, hers. And I am out as a cisgender female who is in a very happy lesbian relationship. But it really does make a difference when I see people on email signatures, you know, recognizing pronouns, because it just shows that they're cognizant of the diversity that's present, you know, and then just being mindful. I think it's great.
Wow. Both of you just gave me so many resources and things to think about, both, you know, that I should do as an institution to show value and care about this issue of inclusivity and bringing diversity into our workforce. And a lot of, you know, you've given me so many resources, and Dr. Shapiro, I will definitely need to register my institution to get a membership at the Association of Outsurgents and Allies as a first step right after this call.
Well, keep in mind, first, a full disclosure, it is a sponsorship. So we do ask for funding for it because it helps the organization, but it really gets to, it also helps you get recognized as an institution that recognizes that being a problem or being a need.
And I will advocate for that get my chair to sign off on this. And then there were some other great terms that came out, like sponsorship, mentorship, allyship. Those were the words that I keep hearing. And I congratulate you, Dr. Rasik, for being a trainee. And like you said, I mean, in terms of not only learning surgery, doing the research, but also putting in all this time. And I recently saw that you had published on the topic of cross mentoring. And I'm really interested, and I want our listeners to kind of learn about you know, cross mentoring. What does that mean? And how is that a helpful way for us to increase inclusivity?
Well, thank you. And, you know, I am very excited about cross mentorship. So I think just to kind of give everyone a little bit of an overview. So cross mentorship is really when you're mentoring across identity differences. So the mentor and the mentee are not alike in some way. And sometimes this may be more of a superficial difference that may be more visible. So, right. So sometimes you may, like, differences vary in their visibility, which I think is always important to emphasize. And so, you know, gender, race, ethnicity, age, even position, you know, some people could argue that those are visible, but they're not always so visible. And I think also there's the intersectionality component too. So you may be working within multiple differences at a time. And so we at the Association of Women Surgeons He for She Committee around 2020 or 2021, we started introducing this term because we realized that the surgical workforce is diversifying. And so how do we support mentors that are practicing in a diverse space so that they can be the best support system for their mentees, and just being cognizant of what are their differences and how those differences could, you know, contextualize their training experience a little bit different than the person standing next to them. And I think that's extremely important when you start considering on creating an equitable training environment, not, you know, equal, but equitable. And so what we initially started the year prior was we actually did a webinar series that focused on different training positions. So cross mentorship for students, then residents, and then faculty. And really what we did is we gave a little bit of an overview of what cross mentorship was, how mentorship can be utilized as a tool to supplement the surgical training experience. And then we ended up exploring case-based scenarios that were cultivated and essentially constructed by the committee. And then we utilize the small group discussions to unearth different identities and what are potential, experiences of the two people that are described in the case, and then what could be a challenge that came about mentoring. And then we opened it up to the group to essentially ask what are strategies to support this mentee throughout the process. And so I think it's important to emphasize that we can't really, every scenario is extremely unique and different. And so you can't really give like a blanket set of rules of this is how you deal with diverse trainees, but you can give guidance and recommendations and, how do you approach the scenarios and what are your resources? And so this has kind of evolved to this year, and we actually expanded it, recognizing it not so much as the differing roles of each individual in surgery, but more so about the identity. So we wanted to use, and it's currently ongoing now, but to use these workshop series to focus on identity group, whether it's gender differences. We have one that focuses on racial differences and another that looks at the LGBTQIA plus community. And we've even expanded another session to talk about disability and ability in the surgical workforce. And then summarizing that with intersectionality and evaluating what are institutional barriers to mentoring, and then how do we overcome that with national societies and other resources we have in the surgical community. And so we're hoping to have the completion of this study by May. And then we can discuss if, having these small group sessions, if they actually assist with improving cultural diversity awareness. And then seeing if the mentors felt that this got offered them some advice and some guidance throughout their participation, and if that translated to their personal experiences.
Wow, how exciting. And I will definitely want to keep in touch with you so I can get those faculty development opportunities, curriculum into my own institution to improve the environment here. I was wondering, I know that Dr. Shapiro has had a longer time span in the surgical work field and training and workforce. And I was wondering if you could tell us about some of the challenges or barriers that you see. And, because obviously we have the resources, we have these
We have them now.
So what are the challenges?
I think that there's several challenges, and I'll tell you the one that I've seen and or experienced by myself, from others as well. And I'll give you one of my first examples. I always start with a story. I was in the operating room. I'm now a non-operating surgeon. I'm an administrator, so I don't go to the operating room anymore, which I miss a bit, but I miss mostly the residents. And one of my premier amazing chief residents from a couple of years ago was in the room with me, and she was doing the case because I just sat there and watched her operate because she was awesome at it. And she was the chief resident. There was a junior resident, also a woman. And there were three other people in the room, including the nurse anesthetist, the circulator, and then a student who were observing, and all women except me. And someone came in, and the resident made a comment about the texture of something in the bowel. And the person who came in the room, a male, said, "That's what she said." Now, even something so innocuous as that, which was famous for the show The Office, it was used for years. If you look back at some of those things, you realize that those comments don't translate anymore, and you can't use them, and you can't make people feel like they're being victimized. However minor it may seem from the outside, you're putting them into a category that is less, and you can't do that. So whether it's by gender in that example, whether it's by sexuality. So I was in the room with a patient, and I was interviewing the patient, and the patient identified as he, him, and anatomically had not had bottom surgery, but was a trans male. And one of the residents made a comment as we left the room and said, "She," And I corrected the resident, said, you mean him. And there was a language difference there. Now, I won't say language barrier, language difference. And the resident said, oh, yes, him, and moved on. Down the hallway, one of the nursing staff heard something and said, yes, and made a pejorative term and used it, said it out loud. And so we had a moment where I had to choose exactly what Gordana was just talking about, to either ignore it, which is not conducive to supporting your folks around you, go along with it, which is contradictory to making anyone feel supported, or address it. So I took that person aside and I said, listen, that word that you just used is completely inappropriate. It is unprofessional. And it's actually quite insulting to some people. And I want you to think about that. And if you'd like a lesson on it, I'm glad to give it to you. This is not punitive. It's just me informing you. Later on that day, that person came back to me and in front of the entire group said, hey, everyone, I said something earlier that I didn't know was insensitive. Now I know it. I appreciate you being correcting me. It was the greatest experience it could have been when it comes to it. But I've also been present where, in one of the articles I wrote, I tell the story when I was interviewing at a place in the New England area for residency, and the whether I present masculine or present feminine in traditional senses or what people think are traditional, or I present in a certain way, I wore my bow tie, I had my suit on, and I was looking all ready for my residency and looked the same as I did now, except with a red beard instead of a gray beard. And I walked in the door of the interviewer, and he looked at me and said, have a seat. As long as you're not going to have a baby or be gay in my residency, you'll be fine. He used some other choice words, but I had to make a choice then as well. Was I going to sit there and take it and pretend not to be who I was? Was I going to say something to him, or was I going to do something else? So I did the kind of wimp's way out. I left. I just walked out the door. I heard him say, where'd you go? And then I just left. I told the coordinator why I was leaving, and she apologized, and I went on my way. I did not go to that residency, clearly. If I see that a resident is experiencing that type of thing in my neighborhood of the world, whether it's at my hospital or in my system, my job is to act. And it's to act not just vocally, but also give feedback to people and tell them in writing, this happened, this needs to not happen, because we can't let small events merely remain anecdotes. They have to be examples and demonstrations of giving people the power that they deserve. And I think everyone has to have that. So I've gone from being a very closeted medical student and resident to evolving into my fourth and chief year, being very out with my colleagues, going to a fellowship where I was completely out and very happy to be there, and coming back to my, you know, where I did my residency, it was here. I came back to it and I said, this is my chance to be representative. And so there was a trans candidate that was once interviewing for a position. I won't mention what position. It was not in our residency. And someone said, oh, that's just such, it's so much drama. And so we had a compliance discussion about that. And that situation went away. I didn't sweep it under the rug. I addressed it. And I think the most important thing we can do is earn that bravery merit badge by saying something when you see it, and recognizing that that action itself, even if it's outside of the earshot or read shot of somebody else, is what real integrity is about. I'm not going to toot my own horn and say that I always had integrity, but I've learned to develop it, because these people that are applying to programs are too important to pass up. They have surgical talent, they have diagnostic talent, and they have interhuman talent that makes them great parts of the surgical workforce. And I want to pull them in. I want them to be part of it. I'll leave it at that.
Wow. Thank you for sharing that, and for your bravery in you know, addressing microaggression. Honestly, I think we've all been in those situations, and surgical culture is a place where it's a lot easier, and sometimes you're afraid because of hierarchy, to just stay kind of head down and go along with things. And I was wondering if Dr. Masek can kind of talk about how you are able to find like the courage and really the support you needed to really navigate such challenging waters, because I do think sometimes we're like, you know, we're like a sports team, like we all have to look the same and do the same things in order to be accepted and included in this circle.
Yeah, of course. Well, I can kind of give a little bit of background of, you know, like a little bit about my past. So originally I was not out from, you know, a career standpoint. My friends knew, my family didn't. And from a career standpoint, they didn't as well. And I think part of that was, you know, I was on a surgical rotation. It was one of the emergency general surgery rotations. We had a visiting resident. And so, and they were essentially a senior of the group. And we ended up actually having this patient that came in, a transgender female patient. And unfortunately, she ended up having undergoing a legal body modification. And then that was complicated with series of notable infections. And we had to take her back multiple times for a wound debridement. And I will say it was an honor and a privilege to be part of her care. Even though people didn't know about my identity, from my standpoint, this patient represented the community I grew up with in Chicago. These are my friends. These are people I consider my family. And so I consider that a gift. And so we ended up grabbing lunch as a team after rounds, and a senior resident ended up making a lot of pejorative statements about gender identity and dismissing it and mocking it to this point of, you know, saying that gender identity, you know, they're just really dismissing the complexity of it. And then even making some transphobic remarks. And so, you know, I took a stance, to say that, you know, just because you don't understand something that's that, you know, and the complexity of it doesn't mean it's silly and it doesn't mean it's ridiculous, but we can discuss it further. And I was quickly dismissed. But having that kind of experience, right, and no one around me to speak up on it, regardless if they knew my identity or not, I really didn't feel included. And so with that, I really didn't feel comfortable coming out, especially during the application process. Like some people knew about me, but not everyone. And if this was happening around me, I don't know what was happening elsewhere. And, I will say that when I did arrive for residency, there was a celebration of just so many different identities. There was a big LGBTQIA plus community here at Boston Medical Center amongst a lot of the, health professionals that are out. And everyone I saw had a badge that, you know, had a rainbow on their badge. And then I just was like, oh, this is a thing. And I saw that all these pronouns were being utilized. And I was like, oh, this is wonderful. Because I, you know, I felt like this was already inclusive, right? And I think this is kind of what Dr. Shapiro was mentioning when he meant, you know, carries his badge, is to show people that they are included here, regardless if they're the intended audience or not. It is a symbol. And so to me, seeing how supportive the faculty were of like other residents, I felt comfortable coming out. And it's, you know, I'm very fortunate to have had such a wonderful experience. Where I bring my girlfriend over to our chair's house when she does have department dinners, and, you know, people ask me how she is, and she's very integrated in my life. And, you know, I felt more comfortable to be even more out in social media. And I will be so in my fellowship application process, but not everyone has that at every institution. And that's the hard part. And I think, one of the things that we're constantly getting asked is like from medical students, but also I think residents, and even faculty question this is, do I come out from a career standpoint, and place this on my application? And how is this going to affect me? Because unfortunately you can't promise that, someone's going to be protected from implicit biases and microaggressions But that is a topic that warrants a lot of conversation, a lot of contemplation, and a lot of discussion with that applicant, and really giving them the most information to decide if they are comfortable coming out. And I think that's like the one thing that has come up a lot. I work a lot with medical students for the application for residency, and just giving them the information to say, these are your options. But it's your decision, and really considering, how that's going to affect them.
Can I mention one other small comment? Dr. Wang, you mentioned the word micro versus macro oppression. And what I was describing earlier, when someone makes a pejorative comment in front of someone at the expense of others, whether they pay attention or not, that is absolutely 100% a macro aggression. That is an overt gesture by that person. Whether they mean to be funny or mean to insult, it is a macro aggression. The microaggressions people use can be as simple as misgendering someone. When someone says to, if I were to meet Gordana for the first time, well, let's just say that I meet Gordana's, hopefully someday, children, if you want to have them. If I say something to you, and that's not an assumption, it's just a guess, but if I said to your child, oh, where's your mom and dad? That is a microaggression. I could just say, where are your parents? Because parents are non-gender. They're also, it's not binary. Mom and dad, binary. Parents, non-gendered, non-binary. There's such a subtle difference between making a small error and then correcting it versus drawing attention to it. The most important thing, one of my best friends from med school told me, who is trans and he/they, is if you make an error with gendering, just correct it fast. Instead of saying, if I were to say, Dr. Rasik, and then you move on, don't draw attention to it. It matters a little bit, and it's important to get the name right. But what you did was you corrected it, which is perfect. Then you moved on. You didn't have to worry about, oh, I'm so sorry, my so-and-so's friend has the same last name. Don't go into it. It's a small item that's very important to correct. And if you make the error and somebody corrects you, then you have the chance to say, oh, I'm so sorry. Now I know. And then you move on from there. Because gendering, sexuality, sexual identity, gender expression, gender identity, all those concepts should be so ordinary to us that they don't prompt someone to make an error anymore. That's what the nature of true tolerance, acceptance, and inclusivity is. Tolerance is just saying, okay, fine. Acceptance is saying, okay, be part of us. Encouragement, enthusiasm, advocacy, that says, come on with me. That's sponsorship. That's bringing people forward. So it's the difference between micro and macro, and it's the difference between micro and macro when it comes to, I'll listen to your talk versus, can I help you with what you're doing? I'm here to let you run things by me and go to the next step.
Wow. I know the hour's getting late, and I've learned so much in the time I've spent with the both of you. And I want our listeners to have some big takeaway points, concluding points. I have some in my mind already from this conversation, but I'd like to hear what the big takeaways that you want listeners who are mostly surgical educators take away from our conversation here. Either one of you can start.
Brianna, after you.
Yeah. I think some of the things that there's a lot to take away from here. I think the first thing is that, which all of us agree, is that we all deserve to be here. We all are, we all have wonderful skills and potential, and our unique experiences are what gives us our strength. And celebrating those differences are going to be essentially helpful to cultivating a more inclusive environment and really just advocating better for our patients. I think when you do see a micro or a macro aggression occur, rather than just seeing it, is really asking yourself, what is the next step I can take? Whether that's reporting on someone's behalf for them, or really kind of addressing it at that moment, and really using it as an opportunity for education. So then that way we can continue to build a more inclusive environment as we proceed. You know, I think the other thing to consider is also asking ourselves, well, what is required of our institution at this moment? We've discussed a lot of things that we can do from a national standpoint too. But, you know, I think if we're all trying to take something away and bring this back to our home institutions, it's like, well, what is the current need of your institution? And what resource is probably going to be the most impactful or is the most urgent of what the resources we discussed? And then implementing that and then considering what are next resources you can implement. I'll leave that for right now, but I feel like there's a lot that we discuss.
I think for surgical educators, I think the single most important thing to do is just be open. Listen, talk, you can feel free to ask your residency, or I should say this a better way. Tell your residents that if anyone wants to be a representative to the AOSA or wants to be a member, here's how to do it. Just introducing them to that concept can be helpful. And then buy a pride pin, wear it, wear your pronouns on your sleeve, on your lapel, offering the opportunity, if anybody wants a pride pin, let me buy it for you, because that one, not a pride pin, a pronoun pin. That way you're doing something both for the patients and for the residents. Acknowledging it is easy.
Thank you so much to both of you. There was so much in here that I'm going to unpack after this call. And I encourage the listeners to please continue to tune in as we learn from our experts on these important topics. And that also come and be a member of the ASE. We are, this is where we can all connect with each other. And part of the action that we can take to improve our surgical workforce. Thanks, everyone.
And that wraps up another edition of the ASC podcast brought to you by the Communications Committee of the Association for Surgical Education. You can check out many great resources on the ASC website at www.surgicaleducation.com. And be sure to subscribe to our podcast series where we discuss pressing issues in surgical education. We invite you to join the ASC and get involved, and wish you much success in your pursuit of surgical education excellence.